This evening's scripture reading is Hebrews 11, 8 through 16. It's Hebrews 11, 8 through 16. By faith, Abraham, when he was called, obeyed to go out unto a place which he was to receive for an inheritance. And he went out, not knowing whither he went. By faith, he became a sojourner in the land of promise, as in a land not his own, dwelling in tents with Isaac and Jacob, the heirs with him of the same promise. For he looked for the city which hath the foundations, whose builder and maker is God. By faith, even Sarah herself received power to conceive seed when she was past age, since she counted him faithful who had promised. Wherefore also there sprang of one, and him as good as dead, so many as the stars of heaven in multitude, and as the sand which is by the seashore innumerable. These all died in faith, not having received the promises, but having seen them and greeted them from afar, and having confessed that they were strangers and pilgrims on the earth. For they that say such things make it manifest that they are seeking for a country of their own. And if indeed they had been mindful of that country from which they went out, they would have had opportunity to return. But now they desire a better country, that is, a heavenly. Wherefore God is not ashamed of them to be called their God, for he hath prepared for them a city. It's Hebrews 11, 8 through 16.
Song that we just sang a few minutes ago, number 190, we're marching to Zion. It's very appropriate for what we're going to be talking about this evening. From the scripture that Chris just read to us in Hebrews chapter 11, speaking about Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the way that they lived their lives, says in verse 13, that they confessed themselves that they were strangers and pilgrims on the earth. God had called them out from their country and from their homes where they were comfortable. Abraham was living in his father's house, living with the family, the people that he knew all of his life. And God called them and told them to leave his father's house, leave the city of Haran, to go to a land that he would show him. He didn't know where he was going, but when God told him to go, he willingly took that life upon him and left everything else behind. He took his wife and his nephew, Lot, and what few things they had, and they went where God told them to. And they became, as it were, pilgrims. And it wasn't just Abraham's lifestyle that he was a pilgrim, but his son after him, Isaac, and his son after him, Jacob. As it says here that all three of them, the heirs with him, they were dwelling in tents throughout the whole time, as in a foreign country. Everywhere that they lived, they had no land of their own, yet were living in other people's lands, living with other people who at times despised them. And yet that was the life that they chose to live because God told them to do so. And as the Hebrew writer points out, it was because of their faith that they did so. But I'd like for us to take a few moments this evening to consider two different types of aspects and life that we can have in this life. We can either be, as it were, permanent citizens of this world and seek after the things of this life. We can be as Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, the example that they left behind as sojourners and pilgrims on this earth. When we first consider Abraham, in Genesis chapter 11 through chapter 25, we have the story of Abraham laid out before us. And I have down here listed about how many times that Abraham moved when God told him to leave, and sometimes when Abraham left on his own. But we see first he left from Ur of the Chaldeans and went to the city of Haran. And from there God called him and he went to Canaan. There was a famine that arose in Canaan. He left Canaan, lived in his tent, and went down to Egypt. He got in trouble down there because of decisions that he made in the land of Egypt, and they made him leave Egypt, and he went back to Canaan. There was another famine that came, And Abraham again left on his own and started living in the city of Gerar with the Philistines. He caused more problems for the Philistines there, and he had to leave them as well. And he went back to the land of Canaan yet again. During all this time, Isaac was born, and Isaac was traveling around with Abraham. We see that he lived in the land of Canaan, and after Abraham's death, he went back for a time because of another famine to live with the Philistines. We see that he had a lot of problems with the Philistines after Abraham's death and the time that he left. Abraham had established a small land where he had been feeding his flocks. After he had left the land of the Philistines came back in and filled up all of the wells that Abraham had dug. When Isaac went back to live in the land again, he found that it wasn't the way that they had left it, that the Philistines had filled in all of the wells. And he began redigging the wells that they had used when they lived in the city of Gerar and in the country there with the Philistines. And we see that in the first time, in Genesis chapter 26, verse 18, Isaac's servants dug a well, and the Philistines came and said, "No, the water is ours." He dug a second well, and again they contended with him over the water that he was getting out of the well. And the reason they contended with him was because this was their land. Isaac had no real land in here. He was living, as it were, a pilgrim, a visitor, a sojourner with them. He had no claim to the land that they had, yet they were allowing him to live with them at a time. So when they came and filled up his lands and his wells and claimed them for their own, Isaac had to move and to leave those cities to go to another place, and they dug more wells till finally the Philistines came to him and said, "Let there be peace between us." And they stopped contending with the water for him and let him live where he finally settled for a time. But we see that because the land was not his, but yet it was still theirs, they had a right to push him around, and it made his life very difficult. And we see Jacob as well lived as a pilgrim in all the lands that he lived with. He lived with Isaac, and they moved around. And he started his life, and we pick up in Genesis 28, and he's leaving his father's house when they were living in the land of Canaan. And he goes to live with his uncle, Laban. We see that when he was living with Laban, Laban mistreated him. He deceived him. Jacob agreed to work for Laban for a certain to receive one of his daughters as a wife. Laban deceived him, gave him the other daughter, and said, "If you want to marry the original daughter you wanted to, you have to serve another 7 years for me." So he lived a very hard life, and he was living under someone else's rules the whole time. Someone else's was directing his ways. And we see when he came back and he left Laban's house, he moved constantly throughout the land of Canaan because, again, he was living in someone else's land. It wasn't his own. He moved first to Shechem, and then to Bethel, and then to the city of Ephrath, then on to Hebron. And Jacob eventually ended his life down in the land of Egypt because of another famine. We all know the story of Joseph that brought Jacob and his family down to Egypt. So we see that these men, as we've just read in Hebrews 11, truly lived their lives as pilgrims. They had no permanent home in this life. And the writer of Hebrews points out that that was something acceptable to them because of the faith that they had. God had made a promise to them to give them a land better than these things that they saw. And it says in Hebrews 11 here that they were expecting a city that God had made. In verse 10 it says, of Abraham and Jacob and Isaac, he waited for the city which has foundations, whose builder and maker is God. And we see that these were the types of promises that they lived their life willing to follow. That it was the promise of that better city that God had prepared for them. They were willing to put up with all of the hard times, truly not having a home to rest and to stay in the land here. It's interesting when you do read through Genesis 11 through 50. Every time that they move, it makes a special point to note whose land they were dwelling in. Even though God had promised this land to Abraham's descendants, while they were living there, it was not their land. And again, in Genesis chapter 15 and in verse 13, when one of the early times when God is making this promise to Abraham, he says, "Know certainly that your descendants will be strangers in a land that is not theirs, and will serve them. And they will afflict them for 400 years," speaking of the time that Abraham's descendants, Jacob's children, were living in the land of Egypt. They were afflicted. They were sojourners in the land of Egypt. And they became slaves to the Egyptians because they were, again, living in their land. and the Egyptians enslaved them and tormented them while they were staying there as well. So we see, though, that all of these, as the Hebrew writer points out, lived under promise of something better. In contrast to that, I'd like for us to consider Lot. Lot began the same journey with Abraham when Abraham, Sarah, and Lot all left his father's house in the city of Haran. Lot was one of them that left with Abraham. He went down to Egypt the first time with Abraham. And when they came back, Abraham and Lot both had many flocks and were very wealthy when they left the land of Egypt the first time. And it came so much, they had so many possessions, that the herdsmen began arguing amongst themselves. And we see that Lot was thinking more of how he could better his own possessions in this own life. And he was thinking more of the things of this world than the promises that God had given to Abraham. He knew why Abraham had left. God had called him out of the land of his fathers, and Lot had gone with him. And yet here he's become prosperous in this life. And when Abraham tells him to choose which land he would take, he chose the plains of the Jordan, rich and fertile lands where his flocks might grow stronger and bigger and larger. He might increase the things that he had in this life. We see when he first started that he dwelt in the plains, even as far as Sodom, but he still dwelt in the tents of the plains outside of the city of Sodom. And as time progressed, even though times were beginning to grow harder, we see that Lot had been associated with the people of Sodom, and Abraham had to go out and to save them when they got captured by invading kings that came down and took the cities of Sodom, and Lot included with them. And yet he still stayed with the people of Sodom. We see even down in Genesis chapter 19, Lot is in the city gates of Sodom. That's where the leaders of the city would sit, the judges, the more prominent people of the land would sit in the gates so that the people would know who they were. They were well known to the people in the city. So we see here that while Abraham was still dwelling in tents outside, living in the land of Canaan as a pilgrim throughout the lands, Lot had slowly become more and more associated with these people of Sodom. He'd become a citizen of the city of Sodom. A citizen is one who owes allegiance to a state or to a sovereign. They have their allegiance set somewhere. Abraham was following after the dictates of God, and yet here was Lot. He had thrown in his allegiance with the people of Sodom rather than with God at the time. And that he was willing to become a citizen, to settle down, to work on the things that were more important in this life to him than Abraham was, dwelling in a tent, seeking the things that God had promised instead. We see that this decision meant a lot of heartache for Lot. When he began thinking as one who in the world would think, the things that were important to those in the world, we see that it tormented him. Peter wrote that Lot was tormented by the people that he associated himself with daily. When he saw the things and heard the things the people of Sodom were doing, Lot was a righteous man, and yet he was tormenting himself daily by the things that he was having to hear and to see that the people were doing. And as was pointed out this morning, the things that we need to be wary of, that evil company can corrupt good morals even, as Paul warned the Corinthians. We need to be mindful of the people that we choose to associate ourselves with. Here Abraham lived off by himself as a pilgrim of the lands, not as a citizen of any of these countries, but as a visitor to their lands, living under only God's rule. And here was Lot. He was associated with the city and the things and the wickedness of the city of Sodom, and he had to pay the price for it eventually as well. We see that his family became conformed to the world that they were living around. As Paul warned the Romans as well, do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. The associations that Lot and his family were with as being citizens of the city of Sodom, rather than the affiliations that they had had previously with Abraham, the affiliations that they had there, saw that his daughters became corrupted. After they left, they committed fornication with their father, because of the way that their mind was thinking, that they had to raise up seed to the parents' name. We see that his son-in-laws had been killed and destroyed in the city of Sodom because they didn't want to leave there either. And even his wife had grown accustomed to the ways of Sodom. And when she had left with him, she turned back, looking again at the things of Sodom that were being destroyed. We see that it costs Lot a lot to have been, to become a citizen with the world, to be associated with those people in the city of Sodom. And it brings to mind an important point that we know we mention often, but there are multiple warnings about the riches of this world that so easily ensnare us in the Bible. The Proverbs are just littered with all sorts of warnings against the becoming a slave of riches in this life. I'd like for us to consider and read Proverbs chapter 23. Proverbs chapter 23 gives us some insight to some of the aspects of what riches can do to our lives. Proverbs chapter 23, beginning in verse 4, it says, "Do not overwork to be rich, because of your own understanding cease. Will you set your eyes on that which is not? For riches certainly make themselves wings. They fly away like an eagle toward heaven." Consider what he's saying here. There are some who work and work and work because the end result that they want is to have more things in this life. They don't realize that, as the proverb writer here says, the riches make themselves wings, they fly away. These things aren't eternal. You're working and working, and yet you still have to spend the money on certain things. We know that riches in these contexts isn't just money and gold, but as we think about the world around us, even in Abraham's time, he was rich considering the people that he was around because he had many flocks. And in today's standards, what is it that people look at when they consider those who are rich? It's those who have many things. You might be rich and not have a lot of money in the accounts, but it's because they spent their money on the housing that they live in, the clothes that they wear, the cars that they drive. The world today looks at us by the things that we have, these material objects. When we're living as a citizen of the world, and the status that the world puts upon the things that we have, the things that we wear, and the things that we eat, the things that we drive around in, that's the things that the world looks at and judges people by. But yet we know that there are more important things in this life. Let's again look over in Proverbs chapter 23, verse 17. Proverb writer says, "Do not let your heart envy sinners, but be zealous for the fear of the Lord all the day. For surely there is a hereafter, and your hope will not be cut off." A lot of times people do dishonest things in order to gain a lot of material objects in this life. And the proverb writer here is saying, do not be envious of the things that you see that the sinners have, their lifestyles, the way that they seem to be treated in this life. Because we have knowledge, just as Abraham did, that there is something beyond this world, that there is a hereafter, that there's something more important than the things that we see in this life. And again, over in Ecclesiastes chapter 4, the writer of Ecclesiastes is given many admonitions as far as the way that we should view riches. Ecclesiastes chapter 4 and verse 8, he says, "There is one alone without companion. He has neither son nor brother, yet there is no end to all his labors. Nor is his eye satisfied with riches, but he never asks, 'For whom do I toil and deprive myself of good?' This also is vanity and a grave misfortune." Just as we read from the proverb writer, there are those who work without end in order to obtain more. And yet at the end, what is it? What's the profit of it? In Proverbs it says the riches will grow wings and fly away. And here it is, this person is alone. They have no companion, they have nobody to be working for other than themselves. And yet it says that all they do is work and work in order to achieve more and more in this life. And what's the goal and the ultimate end of it? The ecclesiastical writer says that this is a vanity and a grave misfortune. It means it's a futile, a vain thing. It has no profit in this life. And again, over in chapter 5, I'd like for us to begin reading in verse 10. Ecclesiastes 5 and verse 10, it says, "He who loves silver will not be satisfied with silver, nor he who loves abundance with increase. This also is vanity." Isn't that the case that we see so often? Those who have a lot in this life only seek to have more and more. Once they have a little bit and they say, "Oh, I'll be satisfied with just this little bit more." Once they have it, they spend their lives and their time seeking even more that they might have again. Verse 11, "When goods increase, they increase who eat them. So what profit have the owners except to see them with their eyes? The sleep of a laboring man is sweet, whether he eats little or much, but the abundance of the rich will not permit him to sleep. There is a severe evil which I have seen under the sun, riches kept for their owner to his hurt, but those riches perish through misfortune. When he begets a son, there is nothing in his hand. As he came from his mother's womb, naked shall he return, to go as he came, and he shall take nothing from his labor, which he may carry away in his hand. And this also is a severe evil. Just exactly as he came, so shall he go. And what profit has he who has labored for the wind? All his days he also eats in darkness, and he has much sorrow and sickness and anger. Consider the picture that the wise man is writing about this person who spends all of his time and all of his energy seeking to have more and more and more in this life. And in the end, what's the ultimate goal of it? He's seeking for things that he can't take with him. As the proverb writer again wrote in 23 and 17 and 18, that we who have the knowledge know that there is a hereafter. And in the hereafter, what good are these riches going to do for you? We all know that when you die, your riches stay here. Everything that you've accumulated in this life stays here in this world. There's not a thing that goes with you beyond it. So what profit is it to have kept back all of these riches for yourself, to have spent your life striving after the things of this world that you have viewed so important throughout the time that you have here? And again, Paul is writing and admonishing the young man Timothy in 1 Timothy chapter 6. The majority of the chapter emphasizes the aspect of those who are rich, the things that riches do to us. So I'd like for us just to consider a few verses from it. In 1 Timothy chapter 6, beginning in verse 3, it says, "If anyone teaches otherwise and does not consent to wholesome words, even the words of our Lord Jesus Christ, and to the doctrine which accords to godliness, he is proud, knowing nothing, but is obsessed with disputes and arguments over words, from which come envy, strife, reviling, evil suspicions, useless wranglings of men of corrupt minds, and destitute of the truth, who suppose that godliness is a means of gain. From such, withdraw yourself." Now consider this even. Here he's saying that there are some who would pervert godliness because they find a way to make gain in this world of it. They can either profit through the pride that they have in this life of having other people look up to them, or there's some, as we even know in the world today, who take advantage of those who think that by sending them lots of money that their sins might be forgiven of them, or God is more favorable by them sending lots of money to some of these people, some of these very corrupt people on TV. There's scandals all the time of these so-called religious leaders who have misused the people who are following after them, who have deceived them, and have gained greatly by it for a while. They're living in mansions, driving expensive cars, spending money affluently, all because they're deceiving people, making an dishonest gain out of a form of godliness. And Paul says, from such withdraw yourselves. But there are people who are even so corrupt to use godliness in a way to deceive people as well. And down in verse 9 he says, "But those who desire to be rich fall into temptation and a snare, and into many foolish and harmful lusts which drown men in destruction and perdition." Again, consider Lot. When he saw the rich plains of the Jordan, and he moved his flocks to feed over there, he did so because he saw it was a fertile land. His flocks would flourish there. He could be profited by living in the plains of the Jordan. And yet, by doing so, he put himself in temptation's way, because he had a desire to be rich in this life. And because of that, he and his family were put into a snare, into temptation. Paul continues in verse 10 of chapter 6, 1 Timothy, "For the love of money is a root of all kinds of evil, for which some have strayed from the faith in their greediness, and pierced themselves through with many sorrows. But you, O man of God, flee these things, and instead pursue righteousness, godliness, faith, love, patience, and gentleness." So instead of pursuing the things of this life, the riches, the respect, the pride of this world, that being somebody who's high in the, as a citizen of this world might gain, Paul is instead telling Timothy, flee these things, flee these lusts after the riches of this world, and rather pursue righteousness, godliness, faith, love, patience, and gentleness. And again, consider in 1 Timothy chapter 6, down in verse 17. Again, he says, command those who are rich in this present age not to be haughty, nor to trust in uncertain riches, but in the living God, who gives us richly all things to enjoy. So again, he's commanding those who are rich to be mindful of the things that these riches can lead you to think, the way that it can alter your mind, the way that it could lead you to away from God, to be mindful of it. And he's commanding them to be mindful of these things. So yes, the Bible has a lot to say about the dangers of riches. And instead, Paul gives many admonitions on what we should be thinking about. Over in Colossians chapter 3, beginning in verse 1, he says, if then you were raised with Christ, seek those things which are above where Christ is, sitting at the right hand of God. Set your mind on things above, not on things on the earth. For you died and your life is hidden with Christ in God. When Christ, who is our life, appears, then you also will appear with him in glory. Therefore put to death your members which are on the earth, fornication, uncleanness, and passion, all of which we talked about this morning, and evil desire and covetousness, which is idolatry, which is what we're talking about tonight. Paul is warning the people in Colossae here to put away these certain things that are enticing to them in this world. He says, put to death your members which are on the earth. So we saw here that that's the point that we're trying to make this evening. We can either be a citizen of this earth, or we can be a citizen of that homeland that Abraham and Isaac and Jacob were seeking after. They were pilgrims on this earth, not citizens. They were strangers in this world because they set their minds on things above. They had a different goal in mind throughout the things that they were doing in this life. Again, over in Philippians chapter 3, Paul is admonishing the brethren here as well to be mindful of these things, what to set your mind on. Philippians chapter 3 and verse 17 beginning, he says, brethren, join in following my example and note those who so walk, as you have us for a pattern. For many walk, of whom I have told you often, and now tell you, even weeping, that they are the enemies of the cross of Christ, whose end is destruction, whose God is their belly, and whose glory is in their shame, who set their mind on earthly things. Consider that. Paul is saying, follow after our example, because there are those out here who do not. Those who do things contrary to the example that you've seen me walking in. And he says that their God is their belly. They're feeding their fleshly desires in this life. He says their glory is in their shame, and they set their mind on earthly things. As he just told the people in Colossae to set your mind on things above. Here in contrast, these people have their mind set on earthly things. How to do better in this life. How to gain more out of this life. And Paul continues, and he encourages the brethren in Philippi, and he says in verse 20, for our citizenship is in heaven, from which we also eagerly wait for the Savior, the Lord Jesus Christ. So consider what he's telling the brethren here. Is your mind on things in this earth, or is your mind on the things above? As he told those in Colossae as well, set your mind on things above, for we are citizens in heaven. There's a big difference between the way that we think when we realize where we're trying to live. Are we living in this life, or are we just strangers spending a little bit of time in this world on our way to a better place, seeking a better home than what we can find here? Philippians chapter 4 and verse 11. Paul says, not that I speak in regard to need, for I have learned in whatever state I am to be content. I know how to be abased, and I know how to abound. Everywhere and in all things I have learned both to be full and to be hungry, both to abound and to suffer need. What's Paul saying here? Is he saying that in order to live a fulfilling life, that he needs to have all sorts of things living through him? Or that he needs to have to be living his life constantly in poverty? No, Paul says that in whatever state I find myself in, I am content, whatever state I am. And he has learned to do those things. He was thankful for the Philippians because they had sent aid to him that he might be able to spend more time in preaching the gospel where he was at. That they had aided in his needs, provided for him. They were willing to take on the help that he needed to have the things necessary for life, for food and clothing, for him and those that were working with him. And yet, here he says, not that I have need of these things, because I have learned to both abound and to be abased. That means to have very little, to be in poverty. But Paul says, I have learned to be content in whatever state I am in. Contented means to be satisfied with one's possessions, one's status, their situation they find themselves in. They're satisfied with it. And how, when we're struggling through difficult times in this life, can we find our way to be content with it? It's because we, like Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and as Paul and the apostles knew, this world is not our home. It's that song that we often sing. This world is not our home. We are only passing through. Because we know that there's something beyond this, something beyond this life. I'd like for us to quickly turn back to Ecclesiastes chapter 5. I'd like to read the other half of that passage. In Ecclesiastes chapter 5, 10 through 17, we had read about how the man who was working and working to save up the riches for himself, and what a miserable life he had. The other side, the positive side, to work in this life. In Ecclesiastes chapter 5 and in verse 18, the wise man says, here is what I have seen. It is good and fitting for one to eat and drink, and to enjoy the good of all his labor in which he toils under the sun all the days of his life, which God gives him. For it is his heritage, or his portion in this life. As for every man to whom God has given riches and wealth, and given him power to eat of it, to receive his heritage and rejoice in his labor, this is the gift of God. For he will not dwell unduly on the days of his life, because God keeps him busy with the joy of his heart. When we realize that we work in order that we might eat, that we might be occupied in this life, we need to understand what the purpose of our work is. It's to help us subsist. We can take care of ourselves. We can take care of others. As Paul is encouraging oftentimes those in the New Testament churches that he wrote to the Corinthians saying that he had taken the care to provide for himself and for those that were with him when he was in Corinth. We know that he joined himself with Aquila and Priscilla at times because they were like tent makers with him and that they would work together as well. Paul worked to provide for himself as well. But that was not his ultimate goal in this life, was just to work, to gain more and more in this world. He understood that it was good to work, to provide for themselves. And as the Ecclesiastes writer says, it is helpful for us so that we will not dwell unduly on the days of our life. There are those who wonder, well, why am I here? Why do I have to do this day in and day out? We're doing the same thing again and again, and life becomes so boring and cumbersome to them. The Ecclesiastes writer is reminding us that it's the true purpose of it, that we should do the things that we have before us, that we should work and enjoy the rewards of our work as well. But above all of that, we're setting our minds on things above. In Matthew chapter 6, Jesus writes something very similar to those people that he's speaking to. In Matthew chapter 6, beginning in verse 19, Jesus says, do not lay up for yourselves treasures on earth where moth and rust destroy and where thieves break in and steal. But lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven where neither moth nor rust destroys and where thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. And that's really the main message of all of these things. Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob were counted among those faithful in the chapter 11 of Hebrews. It says, by faith they did these things, because they set their mind on things above and not on things of this life. And again, over in Matthew chapter 6 and verse 31, he says, therefore, do not worry, saying, what shall we eat, or what shall we drink, or what shall we wear? For after all these things the Gentiles seek, for your heavenly Father knows that you need all these things. But seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all these things shall be added to you. I think it's very interesting to consider the context of who Jesus is talking to here. These people were all Israelites that he was addressing at this time. And he tells them not to worry about the things that they would wear, the things that they would eat, what they would drink. And consider who all these people were and their history. Over in Nehemiah chapter 8, verse 13 through 18, we read of when the people came back from Babylonian captivity. And they were trying to restore the temple and the walls around Jerusalem. The things that they were trying to do to revive the Jewish nation. They found the book of the law. And in the book of the law, it saw that in the seventh month, they were to keep this feast, the Feast of Booths, where for a week they were to go out and find branches from the mountainsides, build booths, and live out in the squares or on their housetops. But they weren't to dwell in their houses. They were to dwell in booths that they made out in the tents. And the purpose of that, over in Leviticus chapter 23, in Leviticus chapter 23, Moses is telling them when he gave this commandment to them, the meaning behind this Feast of the Booths. Leviticus 23, beginning in verse 42, it says, "And you shall dwell in booths for 7 days. All who are native Israelites shall dwell in booths, that your generations may know that I made the children of Israel dwell in booths when I brought them out of the land of Egypt. I am the Lord your God." These were the people who were the descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. They were made to dwell in booths for 40 years as they wandered throughout the wilderness. These people had no home. Again, they were brought out of captivity in Egypt, and they still had no home, no place in this world. I'd like for us to consider the way that these people lived. When we think back about their history, and as soon as God brought them up out of the land of Egypt, in Exodus chapter 15, verses 22 through 27, we see shortly after God had destroyed the Egyptians from behind them and destroyed their foes, the people began complaining to God, saying, "We have no water to drink." They came upon the lake of Marah. It was called Marah because the waters there were bitter to the point where they could not drink it. And they complained even about that. What did God do? God made the water sweet for them so that they could drink it. And then they came a little bit further, and it says that they camped in the God led them to a land called 70 Palms, where there were 12 wells for them to drink from and lots of vegetation for them to eat. God took them and led them in the ways they needed to be to provide for these people. And in the very next chapter, in Exodus chapter 16, in verse 3, we see again that they were complaining to God. "Why have you brought us out of Egypt? Oh, that you had killed us in Egypt. At least we had our meat pots there. We had meat to eat and food and bread till we were filled." They were slaves, and yet they were saying, "Oh, that we were back in Egypt. We had all the food that we wanted back there." And what were they thinking about all that time? Had they not just been fed and watered by God in the wilderness? He had given them food and provided for them. In Exodus 16 and 3, they were complaining again, "Why did you bring us out here?" And I'd like for us to consider a few moments in Deuteronomy chapter 8. I'd like for us to read a few verses where they're remembering the things that God had done for them when they were being led through the wilderness for all those 40 years. And again, remember what we just read in Matthew chapter 6, where Jesus was reminding those people, "Do not worry about the things that you would eat, the things that you will drink, and the things that you will wear." These people should have been mindful of the way that God cared for people and never had worries like that before. Deuteronomy chapter 8, beginning in verse 1, says, "Every commandment which I command you today, you must be careful to observe, that you may live and multiply and go in and possess the land of which the Lord swore to your fathers. And you shall remember that the Lord your God led you all the way these 40 years in the wilderness to humble you and test you, to know what was in your heart, whether you would keep his commandments or not. So he humbled you, allowed you to hunger, and fed you with manna, which you did not know, nor did your fathers know, that he might make you know that man shall not live by bread alone, but man lives by every word that proceeds from the mouth of the Lord. Consider that. God was teaching the people to depend on him. When they observed that feast of the Tabernacle of Booths, is to remind them of the time that they spent wandering in the wilderness throughout all the generations. That was supposed to be a feast they kept every year to remind them of the way that God provided for them and when he led them out of the land of Egypt, the way that they lived, and how God provided for his people. Continuing on in verse 4, thinking about the things of the clothing, he says, "Your garments did not wear out on you, nor did your foot swell these 40 years. You should know in your heart that as man chastens his son, so the Lord your God chastens you. Therefore you shall keep the commandments of the Lord your God to walk in his ways and to fear him. For the Lord your God is bringing you into a good land, a land of brooks of water, of fountains and springs that flow out of valleys and hills, a land of wheat and barley, of vines and fig trees and pomegranates, a land of olive oil and honey, a land in which you will eat bread without scarcity, in which you will lack nothing, a land whose stones are iron and out of whose hills you can dig copper. When you have eaten and are full, then you shall bless the Lord your God for the good land which he has given you. Consider all of these things. Moses said, even while wandering through the wilderness for 40 years, you lacked nothing. God provided all for you. Your clothing did not wear out. Your feet did not swell. You had the things that you needed. He gave them food and through the manna and through the quail that he would bring in the evenings. He provided for them water through the rocks on multiple times. They led them to paths of water where they could be satisfied in that way. And he's leading them to a land rich. He says, so rich with the food that there's no scarcity at all when they're obeying the commands of their God. In verse 11, though, he's warning them, all of these good things will have the temptation to lead you away. Verse 11 of Deuteronomy 8, beware that you do not forget the Lord your God by not keeping his commandments, his judgments, and his statutes, which I command you today, lest, when you have eaten and are full, and have built beautiful houses and dwell in them, and when your herds and your flocks multiply, and your silver and your gold are multiplied, and all that you have is multiplied, when your heart is lifted up, and you forget the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt from the house of bondage. Again, what's he warning them of here? Here he's saying, when you have everything that you need in this life, and you're blessed bountifully, don't forget the Lord your God who gave all of these things to you. The people of Israel, he's warning them here, don't allow these good things that you're about to enjoy to distract you from the things that you have learned these 40 years when God humbled you in the wilderness to understand that God would provide for them. He even instituted these this Feast of the Booths every year to remind them that God provides for his people, the things that he did for them while they were wandering through the wilderness. And here he's warning them, do not become accustomed to these nice things in this world. And don't let it draw you away. So it goes back again to the original question. Where is your citizenship? Are you a citizen of this earth? Or is your citizenship in heaven, as Paul told the Philippians, that they were citizens in heaven? And again, I'd like for us to read quickly over in Hebrews chapter 11. Hebrews chapter 11, verse 13 again. The way that the Hebrew writer describes the mindset of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob as they lived in this life. Hebrews 11 and 13, it says, these all died in faith, not having received the promises, but having seen them afar off, were assured of them, embraced them, and confessed that they were strangers and pilgrims on the earth. For those who say such things declare plainly that they seek a homeland. And truly, if they had called to mind that country from which they had come out, they would have had opportunity to return. But now they desire a better, that is, a heavenly country. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared a city for them. Consider who the Hebrew writer is writing this to. He wasn't writing this to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. He was writing it to his fellow Christians, his brethren, to encourage them. Where is your mind? Where do you have your mind set? And where is your citizenship? Have the mind of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob that we are just pilgrims on this earth. Things of this life are nothing to compare to that place that we have our citizenship. Do we, like them, seek that heavenly country? And it says in verse 16 again, therefore God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared a city for them. So where is your citizenship? Is it like Lot? Are we putting our associations with the people of this world, seeking to better ourselves in this life, forgetting about the hereafter, as the proverb writer encouraged us to be mindful of? Or is it in heaven, as Paul encouraged the Corinthians, or the Philippians and the Colossians, to set their minds on things above, where our citizenship is? And as the Hebrew writer says, that these are seeking that heavenly country, not being a citizen of this life, but a stranger herein. like for us to consider Revelation chapter 22, and then the lesson will be yours. That city that Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob were seeking, the city that God has prepared for His people, is spoken of here in Revelation chapter 22, beginning in verse 14. It says, "Blessed are those who do His commandments," the American Standard Version says, "who wash their robes, that they may have the right to the tree of life and may enter through the gates into that city." Who is it that may enter into the gates of that city? Those who do God's commandments, who wash their robes, who appear clean and pure before Him. "But outside are dogs and sorcerers and sexually immoral and murderers and idolaters and whoever loves and practices a lie." As we read earlier, the covetousness, those who seek these fleshly things are counted as covetousness. And Paul even says that covetousness is idolatry. Those who would seek to make their citizenship in this life, who seek the things to better themselves in this life only. He says, those are outside the city that is prepared. In verse 16 it says, "I, Jesus, have sent my angel to testify to you these things in the churches. I am the root and the offspring of David, the bright and morning star." Verse 17, "And the Spirit and the bride say, Come. Let him who hears say, Come. Let him who thirsts, come. Whoever desires, let him take the water of life freely." And that same invitation is available to us tonight. Where would you have your citizenship? Were you seeking to be in the country that God has prepared for those who would obey Him? If so, then make your life right with Him. Obey His commandments. Wash your robes. Have your sins washed away in the waters of baptism and start that new life, walking as a stranger in this world and a citizen in heaven. Or perhaps you've stumbled upon that life and you're wandering back into the ways of this world. If we can assist you at this time this evening, we ask that you let that be known as we now stand and sing.
To him. and see the hands of those who wish to partake the Lord's Supper this evening. Certainly one of the most notable events in the history of mankind was the death of Christ upon the cross. Nothing perhaps changed.